This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Mumia Abu-Jamal speaks on the U.S. war against fellow political prisoner Julian Assange. A noted writer and anthropologist ponders why so many people that claim to be leftists can't help bad-mouthing the WikiLeaks founder. And a Black doctor in Canada says her profession is in denial about racism. But first, Black women are the fastest growing part of the U.S. prison population, which gives new meaning to Mother's Day in the United States. In Greenville, South Carolina, the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination is part of a coalition that's raising bail money for Black women and girls facing incarceration. Malcolm X Center Director Ifeo Wangaza explains.
It's the third Black Mama's Mother's Day bailout, which is an initiative that was originated by Southerners on New Ground and has expanded to include other organizations who are committed to social justice and among that, bail reform. This is now, it's expanded to be the Black Mama's Mother's Day Bailout Collective for bail reform. And the ultimate objective, of course, is not only to bring our sisters home, but also to eliminate, to abolish money bail altogether, which is just another tax on poor people, most heavily on Black people. When you begin to look at the amount of money that is sucked out of the Black community in various schemes, it's mind-boggling, it is infuriating, and it is no wonder the levels of poverty that we continue to be mired in. The fees and fines, the bail, the lawyers, even with a public defender, there is some expectation of some degree of contribution. The bail bondsman, the bail industry is literally built on the backs of poor people and women in particular. Not only do women expect it, predictably do provide the baseline for the bail industry, but they must also sign contracts to be obligors to ensure that whoever's aid they come, they will also be their keeper and make sure that they appear for court appearances, which are frivolously and disruptively scheduled and canceled and postponed without regard for people's lives and their ability to survive in a capitalist society. So folks wind up losing their jobs, losing their homes, losing their cars, losing their children, especially in the case of women, in light of the fact that 85% of the women who are incarcerated are mothers, that they have children. And if they're not fortunate enough to have family members who will assume responsibility for them, then they're shuttled off into the so-called foster care system, where they become little more than pieces of meat trafficked from one foster care situation to another, providing income to strangers. Now, one of the things interesting on that point, without going too far afield, is that since the opioid, quote unquote, epidemic has emerged as a white folks' problem, now the states are becoming more and more willing, including the state of South Carolina just passed a budget which included funds to family members who take the children. Previously, the amount paid to foster care strangers, they wouldn't even give that amount to relatives. But now, since white folks are having to take care of their grandchildren and nieces and nephews, they are going to allocate funds to give to them. The amount of money that women wind up having to spend for bail, not only for others, but for themselves, impoverishes the community catastrophically. And as bad as it is when a brother goes to jail for the Black community, it's even worse when a Black woman goes to jail because, like it or not, we are a matriarchal people. The cornerstone of our families, of our community, is Black women. So when a Black woman goes to jail, unless she has another Black woman to step up and to take her children and get her out of jail, she more likely than not will spend a disproportionate amount of time locked up simply because she does not have the money and other members of the community have not made the resources available to her to be able to get out. We know that Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to be arrested than white women, 2 to 2.5 times more likely than Latino women, and in every instance, commensurate rates of incarceration for bail and ultimately sentencing and conviction will follow. So the Southerners on New Ground, it brought the initiative to get Black women out of jail on bail in order to begin to challenge the bail system and to mitigate the impact of mass incarceration on the Black community. While the numbers of Black men who are incarcerated is greater than the numbers of Black women who are incarcerated, the rate of incarceration of Black women and girls has escalated in recent years, and where the numbers are declining for males are being made up with females.
And why is that? Why are those trends going in different directions?
Well, first of all, because brother's been locked up for so long, and the numbers at this point are of people left to lock up by comparison is reduced. And there are more programs available to support Black males, both behind the walls and on the streets, than there are for Black women. In addition to that, the level of stress that Black women have sustained over the course of this mass incarceration assault has begun to take its toll psychologically, emotionally, physically, the ability to be able to manage and to manipulate and navigate the system in a way that we have been successfully done in the past. In addition to that is the economics of the situation. The rate of increase has been going on for, I would say, 15 to 20 years. I can remember back in the early days of NCOBRA, because I can talk into Ajwa Ayatora, who at that time was the director of the ACLU's prison project, that studies disclosed that fact. And even though there was an effort to call it to folks' attention, there was little response to it because there's not the fear of women who have been criminalized as there is of males who have been criminalized, but it's been increasing for an extended period of time. And then you see that public benefits, the accessing of public benefits and the claimed or alleged abuses. And I think that Ronald Reagan's Welfare Queen is a perfect example of the hostility towards Black women for accessing public benefits. More recently, we see the hostility towards Black women as represented by, one, the sister in Texas who was sentenced to 5 years in prison because of voting while she was on parole. We see it again in the educational cases where sisters have signed their children up. Even in fact, in one instance where the family was homeless and the only address that they had was her father's address, and they used her father's address to enroll his grandchild into a public school in an adjoining district. And when it was discovered, she was charged with stealing education. But sure, they just made that one up on the spot. I cannot believe that a legislature actually seriously considered that. But she was prosecuted on it and sentenced. I believe she was also sentenced to 5 years. So then we have the so-called food stamp frauds. We have, in addition to that, less common today, but within the time frame and discussion, is the return check fraud situations, where, you know, we think we're going to be able to write a check and make it up in by the time it gets to the bank, or at least by the second time, and the business interest joining with the state being able to put together criminalizing laws that result in women going to jail. I mean, everybody goes to jail, can go to jail as a result of it, but in terms of who they choose to prosecute, how they choose to prosecute and sentence, and under what circumstances, it invariably falls against Black women. As we all know, the charges, the prosecution, the sentencing of Black people generally is more harsh than any other group in this country. And within the Black community, it's Black women who at this point in time are more harshly treated. So we're talking in large measure about economic issues. There was a point at which, of course, when the sale of drugs in our community was high, there were women being prosecuted for making phone calls. For instance, the women that Donald Trump and Kim Kardashian case worked on, where the woman was released, we find that that was a situation where she just made a call and to say, okay, the shipment's going to be here at such and such a time. And she winds up with 25 to life. So it's more survival-based, raw, unadulterated poverty that has led to this situation. And of course, when we talk about 2008, when Obama bailed out the banks and left the people to fend for themselves, Black people lost some extraordinary, over 50% of our resources. I won't call it wealth, of our resources. Then you have, and added to that, the cannibalization of our neighborhoods is represented by so-called gentrification. I'm working on, and have been since February, working on helping a family of two with a severely vulnerable young adult male to find some place to live. People here in Greenville are doubling and tripling up in households to be able to stay off the street, while the city is spending $40 million to build what they call the Unity Park. And people not only are doubling and tripling up, but there are people who are actually sleeping on benches on Main Street and under bridges. So the perverse, inhumane, violative nature of this society continues to crush the most vulnerable, and the most vulnerable are women and children.
Yes, the public face of mass Black incarceration is male, so much so that we're relegated to speaking to the females incarcerated on Mother's Day.
That's right. It's an afterthought. And one of the goals of this campaign is to change that, to put women front and center on the question of mass incarceration in the same way that the Say Her Name campaign raised the visibility of police violence against Black women. I would add also is the number of women who are incarcerated as a result of defending themselves against domestic violence, and how that is totally ignored. In fact, it's a rare occasion where a woman defends herself against domestic violence. It is recognized as self-defense, and she does not wind up going to prison. So patriarchy is a major factor in the application of mass incarceration, and women, I guess also motivated by the Me Too movement, are now beginning to challenge the presumptions that have guided our movement and our priorities up until this time.
That was Efio Wangaza of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination, speaking from Greenville, South Carolina. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is locked away in a British jail as he prepares to fight extradition to the United States. Assange was recently evicted from his sanctuary at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he'd spent 7 years. Black American political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal has spent 37 years incarcerated in Pennsylvania. He files this report for Prison Radio, titled The Wars Against Assange.
The intrepid journalist and author Glenn Greenwald, in his 2014 work, No Place to Hide, offers a damning portrait of the U.S. media, too long trained to worship at the altars of power as agents of first attack against those journalists who dare to question or expose imperial edicts or escapades. Indeed, Greenwald himself details how establishment reporters begin their attacks by questioning both his status as a journalist and then one's psychological wellness. Now, today, we see these same tactics deployed against Julian Assange of WikiLeaks fame. Assange and his collective, WikiLeaks, have been whistleblowers and transparency activists determined to bring light on government activities everywhere. Ecuador's decision to withdraw its welcome to Assange has exposed him to the venom of the American government, largely for showing U.S. atrocities back in Iraq during the war. In 2008, Greenwald writes, U.S. Army secret reports called WikiLeaks, quote, an enemy of the state, unquote, showing plans to destroy the group. And although Assange didn't work as a reporter, he compiled great amounts of data and shared it with great newspapers, which, while publishing his data, still tried to demonize him, denounce him, and question his sanity. Assange's work has shown how governments, including the U.S., really work. For that, he has earned high praise. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Maximilian Fort is a professor of anthropology at Concordia University in Montreal, Canada. In a recent article, Professor Fort wrote that the U.S. campaign against Julian Assange is really a war against free speech. In addition to the U.S. government's vendetta against Assange, lots of Americans that claim to be part of the left can't seem to resist expressing their personal disdain for the whistleblower.
Yeah, that's certainly the case, and I've seen a lot of that myself as well. There is, at least in the United States and possibly elsewhere as well, I would think even here in Canada to some extent, a resentment against WikiLeaks for having published the DNC and the Podesta emails in the run-up to the 2016 election. So the allegation that's made, the accusation, is that Assange and WikiLeaks willingly, deliberately, knowingly contributed to Donald Trump's electoral victory. And so there's resentment about that. There's also a kind of nationalistic resentment. You know, why is WikiLeaks, and by the way, it's a false accusation, but they make it anyway. Why is WikiLeaks always focused on revealing U.S. wrongdoing? How come it doesn't have information on America's adversaries? So this idea that, and some actually call them this, the idea that Julian Assange is a traitor. I suppose they don't know that he's not actually an American citizen, but that doesn't stop them from saying it anyway. So you're right. There has been this sort of swing in the American left, speaking broadly. And it's relatively recent. It's of the last 3 or 4 years when WikiLeaks was revealing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. It was treated as basically a heroic force working in the public interest. In my view, that role, that initial assessment was the correct one. The incorrect one is the way things have swung in recent years.
Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, seems to have invented a category of malefactor for Julian Assange all his own. He calls him a hostile non-state intelligence service operator.
Yeah, well, that basically describes you. It describes me. It describes virtually everyone who resists control by the national security state that would like to control what we know and what we think. And it also shows, and it's a very dangerous hand to play in public, but Pompeo is the kind of person to do it. It shows that the idea that Assange is going to receive a fair trial, it'll be neutral, objective, impartial, and according to the law, and so on and so forth, is basically a falsehood. This is a political prosecution. It's been, how do I put it, shaped that way at its inception. And that also means something else, that Assange is, in effect, a political prisoner. But that hostile non-state intelligence service nonsense is part of a long line of demonization of WikiLeaks from sources in the U.S. government that extends back now at almost a decade. We used to hear things of a similar nature coming out of the Obama administration as well.
Meanwhile, the U.S. corporate media is intent on proving that it's not a hostile non-state intelligence service, but something quite different.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing that you've said, because they certainly are not hostile to the state when we're dealing with the corporate media. In fact, we have this real problem in the United States. We're accustomed to using the phrase state-supported or state-controlled media when referring to so-called totalitarian regimes. In the United States, the difficulty that arises is in deciding whether there is a state-controlled media, and you could make the argument that there is, or a media-controlled state, and you could also make that argument. I mean, there's enough evidence to make both arguments. But let's put it this way. What is routinely referred to as either the corporate media or the mainstream media, the majority of the media, they are certainly not opposed to the interests of the U.S. state, and they manifest that repeatedly. And one of the things that we were reminded about with WikiLeaks and about the case of Chelsea Manning, this goes back right to the beginning with the release of that collateral murder video. Something that when Chelsea Manning saw it, really incensed Manning and was one of the things that drove her to, you know, make this of information available, especially since the military was doing absolutely nothing to prosecute obvious war crimes and crimes against humanity. What we know of that time is that a Washington Post correspondent, David Finkel, who was in Iraq and was embedded with that very same helicopter unit shown in the combat video, had that information, did nothing, said nothing, and was part of the cover-up. So if we were relying on the Washington Post to tell us the truth, we would never have had it. We only had it as a result of Chelsea Manning and then secondarily WikiLeaks. So in a sense, from that point of view, what Pompeo said has a little element of veracity to it, in the sense that WikiLeaks is certainly not a tool of the U.S. state. And I think that that is being construed as being its, you know, major crime.
At one point, the corporate media made big use of WikiLeaks material. Where did they turn against WikiLeaks, or was there any point in time?
Oh, that's an excellent question. And I'll be very frank with you and tell you that I'm not sure I know the answer to that. We did see, but you know, we're not clear if this is, if there's something occurring underneath the surface. But on the surface, we saw a great deal of personal animosity developing between the media and WikiLeaks. There were certainly differences in objectives. The media wanted to cover up certain things that WikiLeaks wanted to make prominent. There was a difference in priorities, so the media went ahead and made maximum use of certain stories. For example, stories about the Iranian government supposedly supplying funding or equipment to insurgent forces in Afghanistan. They wanted to make a big deal out of that, and WikiLeaks was not so much interested in maximizing attention on that story. So we had all these different reports that there was certainly a great deal of jealousy, distrust. The media did not like Julian Assange being in control of the process of redacting leaks and, you know, scheduling and organizing the release of leaks. So there was that kind of professional competition going on as well. And it was a pretty unwieldy thing that WikiLeaks was organizing. It was getting a bunch of competitors into one room together to work together. And eventually they turned on Julian Assange personally with a vengeance. And that has been true of a lot of people. There have been a lot of people that have praised WikiLeaks and then have gone on to denounce them. The worst example of that, or I should say the best example of the worst behavior, has been Donald Trump himself. You know, I forget what the final count was, whether it was 140 or 160 times in his final month of campaigning that Trump praised WikiLeaks, proclaiming, "I love WikiLeaks." And it's his government that is prosecuting WikiLeaks.
WikiLeaks wasn't set up just for the purpose of feeding information to the corporate media, although that is an efficient way of disseminating information, but to make it available to everybody, to civil society, if you will. And you've made much use of it.
Oh, yes. I have an enormous amount to be thankful for when it comes to the work of WikiLeaks and Chelsea Manning. There's a great deal that I've done that simply couldn't have been done without their work. And that is true of many others as well. That information is still freely available to anyone who wants to make use of it. Unfortunately, many academics have not done so. But in my case, I had the Afghan war diary was immensely beneficial when I was investigating a U.S. civilian army program called the Human Terrain System. The Iraq war logs were also very important in revealing information and certainly numbers that we did not know about the numbers of civilian deaths in Iraq, those killed by U.S. forces and under what circumstances. Another important story that came out of the Iraq war logs is the case of two Americans. I don't know how widely known they are in the United States. It's the case of Donald Vance and Nathan Ertel. Might be Ertel. These are two Americans who were detained by U.S. forces in Iraq and tortured for whistleblowing on a private contractor that was engaged in corruption. They were selling liquor to U.S. troops and getting weapons and ammunition and then selling that ammunition to local forces in Iraq. Vance and Ertel exposed this. They were captured by U.S. forces and imprisoned along with the Iraqis and subjected to the exact same abuse as the Iraqis. They then tried to sue Donald Rumsfeld because he had authorized the use of torture. And ultimately, it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court sided without any explanation with lower courts that had tried to stifle their case. So their case, unfortunately, has gone nowhere. Also magnificent was what was known as Cablegate, the release of hundreds of thousands of U.S. embassy cables. I wrote a book that relied heavily on that information, a book about the war against Libya. And I don't know that I would have written the book had I not had that kind of information, because it added a depth to it and allowed certain arguments to be made that previously I couldn't have made without that material.
Well, we know that the Trump administration doesn't care much for international organizations. It threatened the International Criminal Court with arresting its personnel if they investigated U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. So the UN's opinion doesn't mean much to them, but it does to many of us. And the UN, a UN working group, issued a report 2-3 years ago saying that Julian Assange had been submitted to an arbitrary detention by the British authorities in the Ecuadorian embassy.
Yeah, that's right. That was that UN working group on arbitrary detention. And I think it was in 2016 that they stated that various forms of deprivation of liberty to which Julian Assange had been subjected constituted a form of arbitrary detention. And they concluded that he not only should be released, he should be compensated. And I certainly agree with their finding. But as you said about Donald Trump and his disrespect towards international organizations, of course, it's not a succession of presidents that have shown the same kind of contempt. He just does it in a way which is much more abrasive and insulting and offensive and clear-cut than his predecessors did. But that certainly is the case, that really what the U.S. government has been interested in, at least, you know, from George W. Bush onwards, you know, we're talking about the Iraq and Afghan wars, is about covering up war crimes, about not having to answer them for them. And in fact, as we speak, I think it was just last night, what came out in the New York Times was a story about Navy SEALs who were warned against reporting the chief of their unit for war crimes. And they were basically smothered in their attempt to get these war crimes prosecuted. You know, this is why we need to have organizations like WikiLeaks. And the chief of their unit was involved in a number of things, stabbing a defenseless teenager to death, sniping a young unarmed girl, sniping an old man, killing both of them, you know, and other things. And these are the sorts of things that the U.S. government is actively trying to hush up. And it does not want to be held accountable for them. It doesn't want to be held accountable for them internationally or nationally. It doesn't want to be accountable to its own citizens. So this is a big problem, because we're not dealing anymore with just freedom of the press and freedom of information and so forth. We're dealing with what basic rights do we have as citizens anymore? Can we exercise citizenship in the absence of information and knowledge about our system of government and about those who presume to govern us? So these are really fundamental questions, and everybody should be alarmed by the U.S. government trying to silence knowledge of these war crimes, which it's doing in a number of ways. You've listed some of them. The prosecution of Assange is yet another. The re-imprisonment of Chelsea Manning, after being pardoned, is yet another.
What the United States never admits is that it has political prisoners. But this saga of Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning is quite evidence to the whole world that not only does the U.S. have political prisoners from the 60s and early 70s still incarcerated, but it's creating new ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at least in a certain sector of American society, there will be those who will point out immediately, saying, you know, if Assange is a political prisoner, he's certainly not the first one. We currently have Leonard Peltier in prison. Mumia Abu-Jamal is seen by many as a political prisoner, and so forth. So you're right. He's certainly not alone.
But we did see this intervention of a kind by the UN Working Group on Assange when he was held in the voluntarily, one might say, involuntarily by a better definition, in the Ecuador embassy. But now it's the Brits who have him officially.
That's right. And this is of great concern to me. Several years ago, and I think Assange will have changed his opinion now, but several years ago, and you'd be able to find this by looking at archives of newspaper articles, Assange was of the opinion that the United Kingdom would never extradite him to the United States because the UK does not extradite people for political offenses. His worry then at that time was Sweden, that if he was sent to Sweden, Sweden would send him to the United States. So it was all about not falling into the clutches of the Swedes. Now that he's in the clutches of the UK, now I think he'd have enough reason to rethink his opinion. First of all, his very first encounter with the UK justice system after his arrest was with a judge who immediately began by insulting Assange, calling him a narcissist. But that should happen in a UK courtroom on such a serious matter, getting so much world attention, already tells you it's not likely that this man is going to get a fair trial. On top of that, and this is even worse, that judge tried to basically seduce Assange into just going ahead with the extradition to the United States, you know, saying, you're wanted on relatively minor matters. It might be in your interest to just get over there, resolve this whole case and get on with your life. And that is like the height of dishonesty, because we know that the initial charge from the U.S. government is just that, an initial one. It's an opening salvo. We know for a fact now, and it's been reported, that there's an ongoing criminal investigation, that more charges will be released, and they could be made public after Assange has arrived in the United States, after he's already been extradited. So there's a serious danger that this entire prosecution of Assange will be a series of kangaroo courts with predetermined outcomes. And the behavior of the UK judge is already an indication that that's happening. He's being held in Belmarsh prison without access to lawyers for 2 weeks. He hasn't been able to have any visits from anyone. He's being held in isolation, and he has an appearance in court May 2nd. Hardly a lot of time is being afforded to him to prepare for the trial. So, yeah, there is a lot here to be gravely concerned about. And, you know, you have Theresa May saying no one is above the law, and we already know that that is a falsehood. I mean, it's even kind of galling that she should say that in a country where Tony Blair walks free after getting the UK involved in a war in Iraq, which was itself a major, the major crime under international law. It was a crime of naked aggression against another state, and it resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis for no good reason. So don't tell me that nobody is above the law. As a matter of practice, there's a whole stratum of people who are above the law.
That was Professor Maximilian Fort speaking from Montreal, Canada. Recently on Black Agenda Radio, Canadian journalist Eternity Martist said a health crisis exists among black people in Toronto, Canada, and that anti-black bias in the medical profession is a big part of the problem. One of the doctors quoted in Martis's article is Onye Norome, a community health specialist in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Dr. Norome says the problem with Canadian healthcare is that doctors are in denial about racism.
So indeed, here in Canada, we do have a universal healthcare system. And I must say, we prefer that to the alternative. So we have a universal healthcare system where people can access healthcare as long as they are residents of the province or they're Canadians, they can access that. So that in and of itself as a baseline is helpful. However, beyond that, it's not perfect. And so as a system that has flaws, one of those flaws are issues of institutional racism. And so what we're starting to see in Canada is more and more patients coming forward to talk about their experiences of racism within Canadian healthcare, regardless of the province, although there is a critical mass of, or the highest numbers of Black people are in provinces like Ontario and Nova Scotia. And so we're seeing that pattern because in the history of North America, whether it's United States or Canada, we do have that history of enslavement of people who are of African descent. And we have the stereotypes that have come with that. And so in Canada, we are not immune to that. And what's new is the fact that we're having more and more people having the voice and having the support to really come forward and say, you know, this is an issue. So this, having institutional racism and experiences of that for patients in healthcare, whether in hospitals or in clinic, is an issue.
A 15-year-old study shows that about 1 in 5 Black women in Canada who were interviewed reported that they saw racism in the healthcare system they've experienced. But the Canadian medical institution seems to be in denial.
Yes, as far as in denial, that is a pervasive issue in Canada. Canada very much has a multicultural approach. We even have legislation on that in thinking about different groups that migrate here and living in harmony with regards to the different cultures. And so it's a really great thing to aspire to, but as a country, we're not there yet. We face a number of barriers when it comes to institutional or systemic racism. And specifically when it comes to anti-Black racism, the United Nations in their most recent visit, because we are in the decade for people of African descent declared by the United Nations, they had a working group that came here to Canada and interviewed leaders and community members and all types of folks of African descent here. And their report showed that they were deeply concerned about institutional anti-Black racism. So not just in the hospitals, but in our justice systems, in our education system, in our employment systems or work conditions. So that's been stated, and it's also been acknowledged that anti-Black racism does exist here by our Prime Minister as well, who put some funding towards addressing some of these issues, particularly with regards to mental health. So I think now there's starting to be an awareness, but people certainly have held on to the denial, particularly people who have not experienced racialization, so namely white Canadians, thinking that, you know, we do live in this perfect multicultural environment where everybody has equal opportunity to reach their full potential, including their health potential. And what we're starting to see in Canada more and more is the voices are rising and saying, we're not there yet. We need to do the work to get there. And in particular, we need to collect the data. We need to engage communities so that we can fix this.
Until you can collect that data, you've been advocating that Canadians extract data from the United States and the UK, where race-based data is assembled. But is that kind of data easy to extrapolate from Black populations in Britain or in Detroit?
No, I mean, actually, myself and other research or clinical colleagues, we use that because we don't have very much here in Canada with regards to race-based or ethnicity-based data. So it's really just we're doing the best we can with what we have. But no, the best approach would be to actually have data that is based on Canadians because our context is quite different. As you mentioned, we do have universal health care. So somebody's income might affect, you know, how easily they're able to drive to or take the bus to a clinic or something like that. But it's not the same kind of barriers in the United States. On the other hand, we have a very diverse population. So the majority of our Black population here in Canada are either immigrants or the descendants of immigrants. We do have a pretty substantial population out east in Nova Scotia that are the descendants of people who had been enslaved or who escaped from slavery. So people who have been here for centuries, but the critical mass of us are either immigrants or the children of immigrants. And so there's a lot of diversity with regards to experiences, histories, cultures, genetics, like all types of things that are different here. And you can't necessarily extrapolate that from American data or from the UK, because the environment is different, but also there's very different groups here. So we need our own data.
Give us some examples of how Black Canadians experience bias in healthcare.
One example that comes to people's attention is with regards to a condition called sickle cell disease. So I imagine many people are already familiar with this, but it's a genetic condition that affects the blood cells and blood flow. And so a person can end up in what we call pain crisis, where they're in really excruciating pain. And so this genetic disorder can be found in many different groups. So you find it in West and Central Africa. You also find it in the Mediterranean and in India. But for the most part, the majority of the population in North America that you'll see who have this condition are descendants from West and Central Africa. So will be, you know, quote unquote, Black when you look at them, or you'll identify them as being part of the Black race. And so when people come in with these horrible pain crises, they're in excruciating pain, they need pain medications, so opioids, so things like morphine, like right away, right? It's a clinical diagnosis. So there's no lab that's going to tell you really that the person is telling, quote unquote, the truth, unless it's really far gone and they're, you know, in a severe state. But really, the guidelines really say that you need to treat the person who has this condition and has a pain crisis within 30 minutes of being seen. It's come from many patients and advocacy groups that that is not the case. If you can picture, you know, a 21-year-old young male, he comes in severe pain, he's got his hoodie on or something like that, and he needs something like morphine, which is considered a narcotic, you know, people can get addicted to it. There are stereotypes that because this is a Black person, a Black patient, that they, one of two things are the stereotypes, either have a different pain threshold, so can tolerate pain more than a white person, which actually comes through the legacy of slavery. So having a different pain threshold, the other is being drug seeking. So these stereotypes that, you know, Black people would be more likely to be addicted to the pain medication. Based on what we know, at least from the United States, we know that Black patients who have sickle cell disease who need these medications are no more likely to be addicted than any other race. But certainly in Canada, where we've actually had, so in 2017, our government released a report that reinforced to doctors what they're supposed to do and to treat the patients within 30 minutes of arrival in the emergency department. But that document also had quotes from patients about their experiences of being ignored when they come in severe pain. So that was a pretty significant report that came out 2 years ago. We also had the Black Health Experiences projects where people were talking about not being believed, right? So their symptoms not being believed. So these are coming out more and more.
In your experience, how receptive now are white doctors in Canada to at least the idea that racial bias exists in their profession?
So I don't have studies on that. I can say that myself, I am invited to clinical and public health places and spaces across the province, and now I would say in a number of provinces, where healthcare providers have come and asked me to speak on this. And in particular, I think people are not comfortable, but willing to explore the issues of implicit bias. So understanding that they're human beings who have taken in all of these different stereotypes about particular groups, particularly with regards to anti-Black racism and the history and legacy of the atrocity we know with slavery, but all of those stereotypes that they've taken in through the media and arts and sometimes even religion can play out even for the healthcare provider who has the best of intentions. So simply thinking that one is colorblind, which is what a lot of people think they are, when you're able to show examples and international evidence, particularly from the United States, but even the few that we have here in Canada, then people are open to that, because then I'm not necessarily judging them or their value system. I'm saying this is what you've absorbed. And on top of that, if you don't start to think about that and reflect on that, then you're going to cause harm. And as physicians, we take the Hippocratic Oath. We know that above all, we want to cause no harm. So where we're able to lay it out and show the impacts of institutionalized racism, of these microaggressions, of being treated differently due to implicit bias, I find a number of different like hospitals, institutions, clinicians are open to the conversation. But I don't have data as to how many people are not open to the conversation, who's not coming to those talks, who is not inviting people like myself and others to come and bring those issues up, I don't have that data. So for the places and spaces I have been invited to, which have been many, people are willing to engage in these conversations and think about how they can do better.
Well, an admission of possible implicit bias is one thing. People can say, well, I didn't realize I was behaving that way. But that 2003 study points to blatant kinds of behavior, like name-calling and racial slurs and overcharging folks because they were Black.
That's something that I haven't seen as much of, but that it makes sense that I haven't seen as much of that because, as we know, explicit racism is less common than implicit, right? So most people like to think of themselves as not being racist, even if they might do racist things. So it's much more common for people to unconsciously do something than the few people who are overtly racist and just do something that is just clearly harmful. I would say for that 2003 report from Women's Health and Women's Hands, it's a little bit more nuanced because there's some intersectionality there. And I think when we're thinking about intersectionality, where people kind of fall under many different categories, unfortunately, in I think any healthcare system, that can affect the quality of care that you get. And so if I recall correctly from that study, those included women who weren't documented Canadians. And so they were, for instance, as you said, charged for services because they were undocumented in Canada and so did not have access to the healthcare system. And so I think that put them in a position of vulnerability where they probably saw the worst case scenarios, if I recall correctly from that study. But that doesn't make it excusable. It just means that those are the kind of complaints that I hear about less often. Certainly happens.
Eternity Martis' article talks about a Black health crisis in Toronto. Is there a crisis?
It depends on her definition of crisis or what she's calling crisis, because I feel like crisis means that there's something sudden that has happened. It's pretty clear from having spoken to people who have been in Canada for a long time, like I said, even in Nova Scotia, that this has been an issue for decades, and I would even guess centuries in Canada. But I think what is happening is that this is now coming to the mainstream. There's now a critical mass of us here. So for instance, in Toronto, 8.4% of the population is Black. So we're reaching kind of a point where quite a few people are comfortable being vocal. There are others who are allies who are encouraging these discussions to happen in places and spaces. And also, like myself, many of us are second generation, so born here. So very much feeling Canadian and very much seeing that there's a difference between how we are treated compared to our other white Canadian counterparts. So I think actually it's more of a time of people being more vocal. I don't think it's a new problem. And to be honest, I don't have a lot of data on that. But given the legacy of anti-Black racism in Canada, I don't think it's that it's new. And so if a crisis means this is something sudden that has come up, I think actually it's been something that has been under the current for a long time and is now coming to the attention, which it needs to. This issue needs to be brought to everyone's attention so that we can do better.
Possibly a better word would be that bias in the medical profession is endemic in Canada.
I think that is a better way of articulating it. And so because now there's a recognition of this, as identified by the United Nations, there's starting to be greater acknowledgement. So for instance, I would say many of the medical schools, including where I teach, the University of Toronto, students are taught about anti-oppression and the harms of oppression. Students, so I'm the Black health team lead. So I actually teach about Black population health issues and in particular focus on the impact of anti-Black racism, both in our general systems, but also in the healthcare system as factors that affect people's health and cause disparities. So I've been in this role for about 3 years now, so it's fairly new. But overall, medical schools across Canada are starting, particularly at the University of Toronto, are starting to teach medical students about the harms of racism and practices like trauma-informed care, different things that they can do to not continue to perpetuate this issue. So for the trainees, that type of teaching is starting to happen. And also, I would say, not only in medical schools, but in nursing schools, in schools of social work, and in a number of other healthcare places of education. So for the people coming up who are starting to get into healthcare, they are learning these things. But I think we're still have to do a lot more to educate and help with the transformation that is required for those who are in practice now and seeing patients now. It is really time for us as Canadians to start to collect race-based data in healthcare institutions and in all our institutions to start to look for, identify, and address institutional racism. The collection of data is necessary, but that's just part of the first steps towards us addressing these issues.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.